Hello, my name is Joni. I am 26 years old. Today is February 15th, 2018. We are in Athens County, Ohio, speaking with my friend Cindy.
Good morning,
Joni. How are you this morning?
Good, Cindy. How are you?
My name is Cindy. I am 24 years old, and we are in Athens County this morning.
Okay, Cindy, can you please tell me the story of your life from childhood up to present?
Absolutely. When I was a little girl growing up, I would say I had a great childhood. Two loving parents that were in the home throughout my entire childhood, obviously until the later death of my mother that we will get to. Growing up, I was very involved in music and drama, anything in that nature. So I really loved the music lessons that my parents bought for me. And they paid for voice lessons and pianos and clarinets, you know, and just all these different things that came together to help me be better in my practice. And so they really saw my love for music, and they really stood behind me on that. I was in the marching band later on in middle school and in high school, and parents obviously were always at these different events that we would have, or different concerts and things that we would put on. Just somebody was always there for me throughout my childhood growing up. I had two brothers who also lived in the house throughout my entire childhood with us. My parents were a little older than most of my peers' parents. They had me, the youngest of three, later on in life. So two older parents, two siblings living in the home, just a really good upbringing. Through high school, as I said, I was in marching band, and so I kind of was, I guess what you might call more of a square. I never partied or drank or did some of the other things that kids were doing that I went to school with. Some of my peers were drinking on the weekends or doing recreational drugs and things of this nature, and I just was never really into that whole scene at that time. This was also high school, I would say, was around the time that I started to develop issues with self-esteem and the way I saw myself when I looked in the mirror. Growing up, I heard a lot of things like, well, you're such a pretty girl in the face. So I internalized that as, well, everything about you on your face is pretty, just not the rest of your body. And I kind of got self-esteem issues from my mother, who was very, God rest her soul, she was a great person, but she tended to say things like, well, if you're not thinner, you won't get a boyfriend, or you need to find a man with money and good looks, so therefore you have to watch your appearance and watch your weight and what you look like and how you present yourself to men. This, as I said, this actually started at a really young age. It's just high school. As I started to develop, it became more more relevant in my life that I had to look a certain way. So the way I looked wasn't maybe as thin as some of my peers that I went to school with, or I wasn't as pretty as some of the girls, or I wasn't a cheerleader or maybe as popular. So I tried to be funny because I knew that was the way of fitting in. If I was funny, people would like me. This is also around the time that I was graduating high school and going into college. I left, went to college. My first year there, I met this boy, and I guess my focus turned more to what boys thought of me at that time than it did on my studies. And so it ended up that my first year of college was also my last year of college at that time. I left school early because I had met this man, I guess I should call him. He was 35 and I was 18 at the time, so he was quite a bit older than me. But I met this man and he really made me feel, I guess, like what I thought a woman should feel like at that time. He was a business owner, and as I said, he was 35 years old, so he's quite a bit older than me at that time. And he was very, I guess I would say, cultured, But he was also a raging alcoholic. Many nights, obviously in the beginning, we would spend our nights drinking with his family, and this is where I started to alienate myself from my family. I began drinking with him socially at first, then it became every weekend, then it was just about every day. And this happened really quickly. This escalated the first year we were together. I spent a total of 5 years with him at this point in time, just drinking and partying, and really this is where I started to step into doing other drugs recreationally. I was introduced to marijuana at this time from the same crowd, I guess, that we ran with. This was the bar crowd, you know, people that were faithfully at the bar every single weekend partying. Weekend warriors is what we like to call it. So these people were introducing me to things like marijuana, cocaine. Pills at this time were, you know, nerve pills. So they were benzodiazepines mostly at that time. This is where I also started to try to hide from my mother, because my mom was really invested in me, I guess you could say. Like I said, she was a pretty good mother, so she wanted to be a part of my life daily. But at the time, this abusive 35-year-old man was also, he was beating me. Mostly, he would black my eyes. Sometimes he would come in drunk on nights when he wouldn't come home for days, and then on the nights when he would come home, that's when I knew I was going to take a beating at this time. I was about 20 years old when the beatings really started to get worse. So we had been together 2 years at this point in time, and I remember laying in bed one night. I was 20 years old, you know, not quite 21, and I remember laying in bed one night, and I hadn't seen this older man for 4 or 5 days. We were still living together in the same home. He just wouldn't come home. And he came in and he wrapped me up in a sheet. And when he wrapped me in that sheet, I guess I was so taken off from, you know, trying to get awake and try to get up, whatever I could do, he had the full advantage of me. And he drugged me outside. I think his full intentions that night were absolutely to kill me, probably to drown me, whatever his plan was. I ended up getting away from him just long enough to save myself that night. But like most of us, you know, I thought that was a one-time issue. I just thought he's doing it just because he's drunk. And I decided I was going to stick by this man's side and stay with him. Now, I'm not sure if it was due to the alcohol or the drugs, but obviously I wasn't thinking clearly. Could have been the young age. I wasn't thinking clearly, and then I ended up staying with this man until I was 24. So from 18 to 24, just the abuse daily. Obviously, the use of alcohol daily and other substances. At 24, though, I decided that I didn't want to be a part of it anymore. I knew something different was out there for me, but I didn't know what. At this time, I was only using on the weekends, you know. I would drink through the week, and then on the weekends, that's when I would really party hard. So there wasn't a problem in my eyes. That was what everybody did in their 20s. So at 24, things were starting to change a little bit in my life. I actually went to work for the first time, because I hadn't had to work up until then. Dating this older man, he took care of everything for me. And if I couldn't get it from him, I would ask my parents, and they would take care of it for me. So I was never really held accountable to work or pay for anything. So I'm starting to work at 24. And lo and behold, I start a relationship with a dear friend of mine, my husband, later on. And when I met this man, he was very charming. And, you know, he swept me off my feet because we were so close of friends, it would just, everything happened really quickly. He and I were together for probably 10 months, married for 10 months, I should say. We got married rather quickly, actually 3 months into the relationship, we got married. So we had spent a total of 13 months together. And I remember I had just, the day it happened, I had just found out I was pregnant with my oldest child. And I had told him, you know, I had told my husband, and I just remember how excited he was about me being pregnant. We had been out mud running or jeeping, whatever, 4x4ing, whatever you'd like to call it, that day, and with a friend of his. And I'm not really sure why, something that day, that evening, just told me to get out of the car. I don't think I'd ever had a stronger feeling to get out of the car, and I don't know if it was because I was sick, just kind of a stomachy thing from being pregnant, or if it really was, you know, my intuition saying I needed to get out of this car. But whatever it was, I ended up telling my husband, you know, asking him to drop me off at my mother's house that night, and which he did. He dropped me off at my mother's house that evening, and he was going to go back out with his friend for a little bit longer, pick me up the next day. Not a big issue. Something we'd done many times before. But this time, it almost seemed like it was different when I said goodbye to him. Our words weren't quite that nice. Everybody in the vehicle, obviously, had been drinking but myself, and I just didn't feel comfortable. I didn't feel comfortable with his friend in the car. I didn't feel comfortable being in the car. I just wanted out. So went to my mother's, went in, passed out. The next morning, about 6 o'clock in the morning, I got awakened to my mother, who never, funny thing, all through my school years, she never used to walk up the stairs. She would always holler up at me to wake up. But this one particular day, I remember my mother walked up the steps, and she said, "Cindy, you've got to get up. There's somebody here to talk to you." And it was like, I just knew. I knew something was wrong in that moment. Just sometimes things align up in the universe, and you just know something tragic has happened. And I said to my mother, I said, "It's my husband, isn't it?" And she shook her head, yes. And she just had this look on her face, so I knew, and I said, "He's dead, isn't he?" And she said, "Yes." And I remember hitting the floor. I don't remember standing back up or even getting down the stairs that morning. I remember little. I just remember there was a state highway patrolman standing at my front door, going through the motions, telling me, you know, that my husband was killed in this car accident, and he couldn't understand where the driver was. And I said, "Well, where is his friend? Where is his friend? It's his vehicle. Where's his friend?" He didn't even know about him. It turns out that the boy driving my husband had got himself out of the car long enough to get all of his guns that he had in the back out, as well as his stash of pot. The only thing left behind was this cooler of beer and my husband. When he wrecked, he probably could have saved his life, we'll never know, because he decided to call his father to come and pick him up instead of calling for help or calling me to call for help or any of that. He left my husband in the car, and he went home and he went to sleep. The only reason my husband was ever found is because a friend of mine had just happened to be driving that road and could see the headlights that morning when he had gotten off from work. It took my brother going out that morning and IDing my husband, obviously, because I had not been informed yet, and that's the only person they knew to call at the time, because they didn't have a clue where I was at. I think that whole scenario really, it broke me. It was at this time now, having to deal with burying a husband and a best friend at that while pregnant with your first child, it really had a toll on me. I remember people saying, "You have to remain calm for the baby. You have to be calm." And that's what I tried to do. I didn't have a time to grieve my husband. People that I had partied with in days before, I remember, even though I was pregnant, I can remember them showing up and people giving me a small baggie of Nerve pills. For instance, I can remember this girl brought me, first thing, a small bag of Nerve pills. Somebody else had brought me a case of beer, you know, just brought these things instantly to my house, just to kind of tell you the type of friends I had at that point in time. And of course, the addict in me, I used. I used that day I found out I was pregnant. It's not something I'm happy to admit. I don't think any of us want to choose to be an addict, but not knowing it then, that's what I was. I always said that was just my way of coping. That was my best phrase was, well, how else do people deal with these things? So after burying my husband and having my first child, things started to get really, really bad. I guess this is where I really started a downhill spiral into the bottom of what they call the bottom of the barrel. My mother was there for me throughout the death of my husband and the birth of my first son, so I didn't really have to be a mother. That's a role she took on for me. It was very rarely that I wasn't seen out every weekend after my husband died and even after I had my son. I still, during my first pregnancy, I still used, I didn't drink, and I didn't take pills, so I didn't think it was a big problem. I did smoke a lot of marijuana at that time. So to me, there was no big issue there. But after I had my son, I noticed that my drinking picked back up again. Every weekend I was going out and I was drinking as a way to drown my problems and in that time get sympathy for things that were happening in my life. That was my way to get sympathy that I wasn't getting from anybody else, really, I guess. So people would just hand me, you know, they would hand me drinks because they felt sorry for me, or they would hand me drugs because they felt sorry for me, and I would take them. Absolutely, I would take them. That was the addict in me. 4 years after the death of my husband, I was pregnant for my second child at this time, single mother still, you know, pregnant from a one-night drunken stand, I'm sure, and just in another bad situation. But I was going to take responsibility and have my child. I was at the hospital, cut to, I'm at the hospital with my mother, and I'm getting ready to go into labor, and things are just, you know, things are great. She's there, I'm there, things are special. And I remember I'm getting ready to go into labor, and of course I had to ask for something because that was it. I couldn't deal with the pain. I of course had to have something. The addict in me was screaming to get something. And then I had my son that evening, and the next day goes by. We are going to get released, and my mother ends up asking to push my wheelchair out of the hospital. So the nurse, she wasn't feeling really good that day, I remember. And so the nurse, you know, walked with us, and as my mom's pushing me along at this time, I remember she had to stop for breaks and breathe. And I was thinking, wow, something, you know, something's just not right here. What is going on? We probably get 10 feet from the door, the outside door of the hospital, and my mother drops over dead of a massive heart attack in the hospital days after I had just had my second born child. So, of course, this is probably the most tragic thing that had ever happened to me. You know, I've lost my husband. Here I am, two children, and now I've just lost my biggest support system, my rock, my savior, when I need saved. You know, and I guess this is the part that gets really messy. With losing my mother, a part of myself died, and my father was not the most wholeheartedly, I want to say he's not your normal, typical father. I remember 2 weeks after my mother died, I was struggling then, you know, still using, obviously, still drinking whenever I could get it. I couldn't do it as much though, because with my mom gone, I didn't have anybody there to leave my kids with, and I didn't have anybody, more importantly, that I could talk to about anything that was going on in my life. I remember I tried to talk to my dad and say, hey, I'm depressed. I have post-traumatic stress disorder along with postpartum. Something is not right with me. I need help. And he said to me, Cindy, you just have to get over it. People die every day. It's part of life. You need to get over it and move on. Wow. That was the big push for me. That's all I needed though, really. I needed those words. I needed something to push me over the edge for me to be able to say, I can use now. And I guess that my father's words were really, really that push that I wanted, honestly. Looking back on it, I wanted a reason to use. And that was it. The very same night, I remember the very same night that my mother had died, the same instant I got home, I went across the street and I said, hey, here's $60. I want you to find me something. Doesn't matter what it is. And that was the straw that broke the camel's back. He came back with an 80 milligram OxyContin, which is very, very strong. And I did half of it there, and I just remember it seemed like instantly every bit of my problems melted away. And so that wasn't enough. Every day, I didn't want to deal with the pain of my mother being gone. I didn't want to deal with the pain of my husband being gone. And I was functioning at this time. A functioning addict is what I like to say. I was still taking care of my kids, going through the movements. Wasn't there for them emotionally, I'm sure, because I couldn't get myself out of the funk that I was in. At this time, I had started to get myself into trouble because after my mother had died, you know, I had to have drugs daily to cope. Had to, in my own thinking. Had to have these drugs or I wasn't going to be able to make it. But I wasn't working, so I had no way to pay for these things. And I started to sneak checks from my dad, get his wallet, you know, the small petty things that you start out doing. That wasn't enough. So a friend, or a girl I thought was my friend at the time, she was in my life and she said, you know what, I'm gonna go to Hawaii. She said, I was in need of a car too around this time. She said, I will sell you a car and you can pay me in pills. Well, in my eyes, that was great because by this time I had started going to my own doctor because I knew I can't pay for this pill, so how am I gonna get them? And so I decided to ask around and I found this doctor that would take you in, didn't matter your age, you know. By this time I'm 25 and just the fact alone, I've lost my husband and my mother and I'm going through all these different issues with depression. I knew that he would give me the benzos, the nerve pills, the Xanax, but I couldn't figure out a way to get pain. So in order to get these pain pills, I had to think of this elaborate story about, you know, how I had hurt my back, because at the time I'm 25 years old, should have a pretty decent back, but anyway, I made this story up and I got to this doctor and I can remember the first time I got pain pills, walked in, first time the guy had ever saw me, and he writes me out a script for 90 Xanaxes and he wrote me out a script for 90 Vicodins, which at the time was like, wow, jackpot. I've really hit it big. So just from a little lie being told to this doctor, you know, yeah, I've got him now to write me these scripts, and so I have extra pills, I can pay this girl in pills, and I can have a car, and everything just seems like it's, okay, we're starting to get somewhere in life. Got to make a change. Well, soon after she leaves, she comes back, and instead of coming to me, she goes to the sheriff's department. She reports the car missing. And I ended up getting myself into trouble because I had no way to show on paper that she had ever, you know, I had purchased this car from her because I had purchased it in pills. So this was the time when I started to go in and out of jail, you know, because I had caught this case and I was first-time offender. So I thought, well, they're just going to give me a little slap on the wrist anyway. Not a big issue. So here I am. I'm 25 and I've now caught this charge for theft of a motor vehicle. I'm strung out on pills. I don't realize it because I think this is what every 25-year-old does. I'm an alcoholic, raging alcoholic, drinking every day, as much hiding it from my family the best I thought I could. Because in my eyes at the time, I was a fully functioning addict. Needless to say, not long after my mother had passed and I was going through these legal troubles, I snapped. One day I just snapped and I couldn't take it anymore. I left for the evening and I remember saying, you know, I remember saying to my family, I'm going out tonight, see you tomorrow, I have a babysitter. Somehow between that time and saying that to them and cut to maybe a couple hours later, I get this phone call saying, you know, Children's Services are here. My friend is calling me, obviously, telling me my friend who is my babysitter is saying, you need to come right away. Your family's here. Your father's here with Children's Services. They're taking, you know, they're taking the baby. You need to get her as quick as possible. Well, I was drunk. I was high, and I couldn't get home because I had found myself in the city 2 hours away from home. That was when my reality really set in that you're an alcoholic, your family knows you're an alcoholic drug addict, you have got to get yourself straightened up, as I think most of us addicts do say to each other, or say to ourselves, you know, we need to get help. But I talked a really good game, I just was never good about going and getting help for those issues. So at this point in time, I'm obviously still doing drugs, so I can't show up to see my probation officer because the judge in the town knew my family, knew the situation I was in, and was kind of lenient, gave me probation for a theft of a motor vehicle with the stipulations that I had to do X, Y, and Z and check in and take random drug tests, which none of this I had even paid attention to. The law did not it didn't appear to me. It didn't. The law was not for me at this point in time. I thought I was above it. So I never checked in, never did the tests I was supposed to. Boom. Find myself getting locked back up. This time it was for 30 days. And by now, I've had, you know, my oldest son was still with me. They had taken my newborn baby and placed him with my brother and his wife. I was in jail. So my father kept my oldest son at the time for me while I did these 30 days in jail. And to me, that was it. I just knew, this is it for me. I'm going to lay down these 30 days, and I'm going to come out. I'm going to be a better person. I'm never going to use. So 30 days go by, and in these 30 days, I'm trying to do a little bit of self-reflecting and things like that. I get out. I go home the first night. I'm there with my father and my son and my family. And of course, I make promises to change that I know I'm definitely not going to keep, because my mind, in the back of my mind, it's always spinning. It's time to get high. It's time to get high. It was such a darkness inside of me, eating away. I like to call it the blackness, because it seemed like this black fog would just come over me from the pit of my stomach and take over my heart. And I didn't care who I hurt. How I got what I wanted. I didn't care about anybody but feeding my addiction and myself, getting high. I had already lost, obviously, my youngest son at the time, and my oldest was now in custody with my dad, even though I was living in the same house. Time rolls around, and now I've met another man who I think is just wonderful. He sells, you know, he sells what I want. He's a dope boy. He has a home. He has cars. He's got money. He was what I wanted. He was the easiest thing that I could set my eye on to get what I wanted. and I got him. I remember I dropped my son off at my dad's, and I didn't know that would be the last time I would see him for 7 years, but it ended up being that way. So I had already lost my youngest, who was living with my brother and my sister-in-law, and now my oldest was in my dad's custody, so I really had no obligations. I go and I live with this new man, and he's just great. He's kind to me, and he's such a sweetheart, and he feeds my habit, and he pays for everything. Things are going well. You know, we make it through our first year together. First year I hadn't seen my son in 1 year. Even though I was in touch with my grandmother, I still wasn't able to see my sons. And then that hurt me, you know. I had all this depression I was dealing with, and I guess being with this man, I could get away from all that depression because he kept me so high that I didn't have to worry about it, feeling any of this. So for all these years now, I've bottled up all these emotions and all this depression, along with all the other anxiety and self-esteem issues and social anxiety disorder and all these different issues that I'm having with my own self and who I am, what I stand for. I just keep stuffing it. And I stuff it down and I stuff it down. So while living with this man, I end up still not going to probation, still not seeing my PO. I end up getting sentenced to prison for the first time. So they say they are going to put me in prison for 18 months for the crime I committed. Here I am, I've lost my kids, I'm in this new relationship, and now I'm going to prison. So I get myself ready and I turn myself in, and I remember thinking I'll be out in no time. This will be a 30-day thing. Surely they'll let me out. Well, while I'm in there, my first couple months, the boyfriend stays with me, and you know, he holds me down per se, and he's there. But what I didn't know is he's seeing another person the whole time. Somebody else is living in my house. He's feeding somebody else's habit, and I'm soon forgot about. Well, so, and this time I had been in prison for 1 year, and they end up releasing me on a judicial, and the boyfriend that I had had, the dope boy boyfriend, he finds out that I'm going to be released, so he writes me and says, please, I love you, let me come pick you up. And in my way of thinking, my addictive thinking, a year wasn't enough to keep me sober. I wanted him to love me, not somebody else. And that was the way I thought the whole time. I had to show that I could get him back. And so, of course, I left that day knowing that he had moved on from pain pills to heroin, which is something I swore I would never touch. So I get out of prison after 1 year, and within 2 hours of being let out, on parole, mind you, because, see, I didn't finish out my whole sentence. I still had 6 months left on this sentence. Within 2 hours of being released from prison the first time, I am shooting up heroin on the way home from the city, and I'm passed out in the front seat the whole way, 2 hours home to our small town. I loved it. Instantly, I loved it. From everything, from watching the blood hit the dope and the needle, to the actual pain of sticking myself, to the ecstasy that you feel after it's released into your body. Everything I'd been thinking about sober that whole year, all those promises I'd made to myself, all those steps that I had made, all those big books I had read, all fell out the window within 2 years after being released from prison. 2 hours after being released from prison. It was so intense, though, I would say, my love for heroin, because I'd never had anything like that. You know, pain pills, you had to go search for them, and they were more expensive. And the thing about the heroin was, it was available, and it was cheap. You know, it was cheap. I was spending $25 to get high versus having to spend $80 or $120 to get high. because at this time they had started to shut down the pill mills around the city in different places. And so pain pills were becoming more and more hard to find. But this heroin was so easy. It seemed like somebody always had heroin. So for about a year and a half, I fueled the relationship I had with him basically on heroin, not knowing that things were going to fall apart again. It ended up that he ended up catching a charge and having to go do a year in prison. And I myself, obviously, was still in addiction heavily. And so within 6 months of his being sentenced to prison, I was stealing checks and writing them to get high because, see, my main source of drugs was gone. He was behind bars and I couldn't get my fix. So I ended up stealing checks off of his mother. They were starter checks. And when I stole these starter checks, it was easy enough for me to go and write them and cash them at our local bank because everybody knew me. And they knew that I took care of his mother. So I probably wrote checks out of her account, I'd say for a month before I was found out. And all in all, I had spent $1,200, I believe, $1,200 in a month. And that was fueling $100 a day habit because now, instead of costing $25 to get high, my tolerance was so built up, it was costing $100 a day, sometimes more than that, just kind of depending on the day. Also, not long after all this, I found out I was pregnant again. I know that sounds crazy when you hear it, you know, three baby daddies, three obviously different baby daddies, and three different children, but that's not really that uncommon in the people, the addiction community, or, you know, the recovery community. Lots of people that were addicted will tell you they have several different fathers of children, or, you know, I didn't know any other way to love but sex at that point in time. And I damn sure didn't love myself enough by any means. So here I am, you know, I'm pregnant with my third child and I'm strung out on heroin and I had nobody because by this time they had found me out about writing the checks and I had lost my place to live. So I'm 28, I'm pregnant, I'm a heroin addict and I'm living on the streets. I would go and stay with people that were fellow heroin users because I would find any which way, whether it be selling off my dead mother's jewelry or stealing, I would get high every day, $100 a day, no matter what it took. I was so dedicated to getting high that I had even forgot about the child that was growing in my stomach. And another issue I'm not proud to admit, I didn't go to the hospital the whole time. The whole 9 months I was pregnant, I never went to the hospital. I had vitamins left over, prenatal vitamins from my past pregnancies, and my way of thinking, the addict's way of thinking, is not the same way a normal person thinks. And I know you'll attest to that, right, Joni?
I agree 100%. You don't. No, you don't.
You know, I know a lot of people would probably, I tried to keep it under wraps for as long as I could. I would wear baggy sweatshirts because I knew if I was ever found out, I would either lose being able to buy dope from somebody or somebody would turn me in. So I couldn't tell anybody I was pregnant because I couldn't get my fix. And I knew from going through being dope sick and then getting dope, finally, I knew that feeling. I knew the cold sweats and the vomiting that comes along with it. And I knew, you know, the horrible shakes that you get from coming off of it. And I knew I didn't want to feel that way, especially not being pregnant. I was smart enough to take all those vitamins I had left over daily, and I tried to eat right when I could. But I was so wrapped up in my addiction that I just didn't care. Truthfully, at that time, I was battling addiction, and I can say now I wanted to die. Life meant nothing. And although the whatever normal means, the normal person can sit there and say, how can you be such a horrible person you know, how can you do that to your unborn child? And I know I make people sick from that. It makes my own self sick. But my way of thinking, the Cindy I was in that time was not the Cindy I am normally. That was a very dark period of time for me. I had never, like I said, still never fully got the chance to mourn for my husband or my mother because I was high every single day.
Masking it.
From, yes. From 2004, I would say, until, besides being locked up, the stints I was locked up, until 2012, yeah, 2004 to 2012, there wasn't a day go by that I didn't have something in my body, something to get me high, something to keep me well. I didn't like to be sick, and I didn't like to go without, period. So I was still using, not going to the doctor, doing the same things, homeless, sleeping on people's couches, and I can remember going. That night, I was going to go out with a friend, and I knew that I was 9 months into my 9th month of pregnancy, still doing the same thing, still sleeping on people's couches, and still obviously stealing food just to be able to eat. I would walk into a convenience store just to steal something to eat because I couldn't eat at my junkie friend's house because they had no food. So I remember we went out that night. And we were going, obviously, to seek drugs. And I remember being in the dope house, and I had just did my shot of heroin. I was having pains in my stomach. I'd been having those pains all day, but I just thought it was cramps, never really thought anything, until my water broke. That's when reality hit. You know, here I am. I've just got this needle out of my arm, and my water's broke. So I called 911 for myself. I'm standing in the middle of this dope house, and the way I'm thinking is I'm going to have this baby in a toilet. I'm going to have this baby in a toilet with a syringe beside of me. I knew that wasn't me, but at the time you couldn't have told me it wasn't. If anything, I was praying, you know, I was praying to God at this time, please, God, help me somehow. Set me down whichever way you have to. I remember the emergency squad came and they got me, and of course I had track marks up and down my arms, which I swore, were bug bites. You know, an addict's way of thinking, that's definitely going to pass off. And I can just remember the way that EMS or EMT worker looked at me. He never judged me. He did help me, obviously, that even though that's his job, I know most people wouldn't have. But he did help me, and he talked to me, and he said, you know, he said, you've got to be honest with yourself. If you are on drugs, you need to let me know. Still, I wouldn't tell him. And I remember I just barely made it to the hospital in time to have my son. And so as soon as I had my son and they put me in the recovery room, I remember thinking, I got to find a way to get high. You know, I know that I only have a few short hours until I go into detox, and I know it's not going to be pretty, and I was trying to think, how am I going to get out of here? What am I going to do with this baby once I get out of here? I had nothing. I didn't have any place to stay. I didn't have any means of income. All I knew was getting high and getting my fix any which way I could. So I had been there for a day and a half when this lady comes in, and she sits down on the end of my bed, and she says her name, and she says she's a social worker with the hospital, and she says, somebody has called in, and they told us that you're a heroin addict, you know, and she said, now you can either be a woman about this and admit it, she said, or you can lie to me. And in that very instant, I thought, wow, you know, this is real. Was then that very instant of that nurse asking me and saying, you can either be a woman about this or you can lie, because, you know, she basically told me I was such a horrible person that I said, I am going to prove this lady wrong. And I did. Now, in my age, fast forward 10 years, I've got myself a degree. I went back to school. I now do corrections work, criminal justice and social service, and I try to devote myself to the recovering addict. Just understand one thing, addiction does not discriminate. You can be the nurse, you can be the leader of a gang, anything, and it will hit your family. So understand, don't ever say it's not me.